Discworld! It's Discworld! Podcast! Analysis! Yeah! Woo!
So I'm Josh, I'm your unseen academical, and I'm going to get right into things for this worst books I read for the first time in 2023 bonus unseen academicals episode countdown. I already did the overall introduction and gave an overview of sort of my reading habits and targets in 2023 at the start of the best books episode that I will have put out at the same time as this. So just going to get straight into it with this one though. Having said that, I do of course want to give out some honorable mentions, or in this case, I guess dishonorable mentions. I've got three that I want to shout out, and these are maybe like not the worst books I read this year, but the most disappointing books, I guess. And one of those, probably the least offensive and really isn't that bad a book, but was built up a lot and is somewhat of a semi-canonical fantasy touchstone, is this is the year I finally got around to reading some Brandon Sanderson books. Started at the beginning with Elantris, which sounded pretty cool. And that book was pretty cool. It was a bit long and, you know, you could tell it was a fairly early, unrefined effort, but some interesting ideas there. Also, he's another author that I was sort of thinking of as a counter or case study to Suvin's theories about fantasy and history. Like, I guess the ideas of Sanderson's work is that they are about society and economics and cultural historical shifts and things, which Elantris very much is. So that's not the dishonorable mention. The dishonorable mention is I then went on to read the first Mistborn novel, The Last Empire, from 2008, which I think is his second novel after Elantris. So I think I was going along, but Mistborn's the big series. And yeah, that one did not do it for me. The whole luck magic thing that it sort of premised on was interesting, but yeah, the story itself was extremely standard and cliche, and I was rolling my eyes a lot, and I don't think it particularly brought anything new or interesting to the table. And he's weird about women, maybe again in a way of it being an earlier effort. Like, I didn't quite get the full-on grotty vibes of something like the Kingkiller Chronicles or whatever, but I was just like, oh, this is like ostensibly a story about a strong independent woman finding herself sort of thing, but you could very much tell it was written by a dude. I don't know, maybe it gets better, but I was certainly put off persevering with that series. I might still read the Stormlight Archive at some point. That seems really cool, but I've had so many people recommend it to me over the years, but they're so long. They're so long. Probably won't be this year, but you never know. Another book I thought I would really like and wound up not even being able to finish was Jeff Vandermeer's A Peculiar Peril from 2020, which was sort of the last of Vandermeer's books that I had to check off when I did my big reread of his stuff last year. And then this is one I had never read, although I do talk about it in my book and some of the articles I've written, because this book, it's a fantasy rather than science fiction book, and it is about a parallel world where, like, magicians who are known for their animal rights activism do battle with an alternative history Aleister Crowley whose magic is powered by animal sacrifice and things. So yeah, I love Vandermeer's stuff, and I'm all about the animal ethics in science fiction and fantasy stuff, so this really should have been for me, and for a little bit it was, but this book is too much. It is all over the place. It's like every idea all at once, which some of Vandermeer's stuff, especially his more recent works, can often tend to be, but this was also like the writing was very, like, kind of a bit on the low random side of things. There was a lot of quipping and then suddenly like a psychic tandem war elephant appeared, except rather than being one of the best episodes of Adventure Time, it was just this big mush of ideas, a lot of which were very cool, but I was really struggling just to work out who related to what and why I should care about any of it. So about 2/3 of the way through, and this was my second attempt to actually read the book, I think I got about 1/4 of the way through the first time, I gave up. I couldn't finish it because it was just all over the place. And then finally, and this is the big one in terms of dishonorable mentions, like, not a bad book, but a book that really didn't live up to the hype, and it has been hyped at me and around me by everyone I know for so long, and that is Mark Z. Danielewski's House of Leaves from the year 2000. Big cult book. But yeah, this book has been hyped and recommended to me for, like, going back decades now. And this was always the book that when I said, hey, I like Infinite Jest, I think it's my favorite book, actually, a lot of people, multiple people would say, you know, that's pretentious garbage. House of Leaves is where it's at. And I came away with the complete opposite opinion. I think House of Leaves is maybe the most pretentious thing I've ever read, besides perhaps the descriptions of Danielewski's other books. And at the core of House of Leaves is a very cool kind of metaphorical horror story about, you know, the actual narrative about the house with the expanding rooms inside it that, you know, are bigger on the outside than they are on the inside, and the journey and the venture into the labyrinth. And even then, like, this book is known for its use of typography. Like, a lot of the pages are have different layouts and words, and they make up collages, and there's a point where things become disorienting and you have to, like, spin the book around. And I found a lot of that quite effective. What I didn't find effective was all the meta commentary stuff that was in it. A annotation, or I guess there's an extra layer where the book you're reading is a reproduction of an annotation of a description of a film that may or may not exist by a blind man about something that may or may not have happened, which is, I'm fine with that in idea, but the actual commentary, Johnny Truant, the actual like narrator of the story and his interjections, which are in a different typeface and go on for pages and things, were some real juvenile trash. Like, they're all about him wanting to have sex with a stripper, and I didn't really get how they related to much of what was going on. They just seemed there. It really seemed like someone trying really hard to do an impression of David Foster Wallace and completely missing the point. I mean, I could go on about New Sincerity and how this sort of thing really forgot about character and heart and just wanted to flex its typographic muscles, but at the same time, like, some of the spinning around disorienting typographic stuff was cool, but, you know, there's an entire chapter that's like looking through a window where there's blocks of text that look like a window, and it's like, it looks cool, but okay, what does it bring to the story? And like, every instance of the word house is in blue, and I don't know why. I really don't particularly care. And I sort of felt this way about the book pretty early on, and I persevered, I got through it, and I do think the actual narrative, the actual story, the House of Leaves story is cool and would have made a pretty cool standalone, shorter, you know, postmodern metafictional horror novel, but House of Leaves as a package was severely disappointing to me and really quite emblematic of, it was well done, I just don't know to what end. Okay, but on to books that I think are actually bad for everyone, not just me. And there's quite a few big names on this list. Like, I've already taken a shot at House of Leaves and Brandon Sanderson, and I'm going to start off with another big god slaying, or is that science slaying, should I say, because I'm kicking this list off with Carl Sagan's Contact from 1985. And I have somewhat of a silly history with Contact in that when I was very young, like 7 or 8 or something, the movie was on TV, and I watched it just because my parents had it on, and I watched it in. I was hanging out in the living room while they were watching it, and I'm there, I'm going, cool, this is a story, we're going to go meet some aliens, we'll travel through space and stuff, and instead it's a boring psychological introspective thing about growing up, and then she meets the aliens, and they just look like her dad, which was extremely disappointing to me as an 8-year-old, and I gotta say, it's pretty disappointing to me as a 33-year-old. Reading the book version. Yeah, so this is the same story with less Matthew McConaughey and not even a little bit of Jodie Foster in there. The ending with the going to meet the aliens and it's just her dad is the same, and it's still like, I get it, but it's just, I would have rather a story about aliens. Like, it would have been really cool to meet some actual aliens, actually. But some of the build up with the, you know, this is a book about receiving a signal from space that is instructing the people on Earth about how to build a ship to go in and meet the aliens. The beginnings of that and the way it passed out for the, like, first third of the book or so was okay, and then, oh my god, it screeches to a halt in the middle and just becomes this whole science versus religion thing, and on top of being like really smug and preachy in like, well, maybe God is science, man, Carl Sagan style approach, it's just extremely dated. Like, maybe this was interesting and kind of innovative in 1985, but in 2023 it is so trite and like try hard and irrelevant, and from that point on the book just really, really drags until we got to the end, and oh, it was, she'd met her dad, and it was all a metaphor for like human relationships, they're what matter. After I took a shot at House of Leaves for missing the point about that, Carl Sagan tried to, but you know, that can still be bad as well. So that was pretty disappointing, and I think that book's generally held up as a classic, and I suspect it's by people who maybe haven't read it in a while. I have a more modern pick for my number 9. We're jumping forward 30 years to 2015 with Paul Tremblay's A Head Full of Ghosts. So I've already talked about Paul Tremblay and one of his books in the Best Books episode, but yes, he is one of the big leading names in modern horror, and this book, A Head Full of Ghosts, along with The Cabin at the End of the World, which was the book that was on my list of best books, are sort of his two main ones, and clearly I liked one and not the other, but they're also like extremely extremely different books. You know, I talked about how I really like the atmosphere and the tension and characterization of Knock at the Cabin. This Head Full of Ghost Books. All right. So to set it up, this is a book that is about, there was a reality TV show about a possessed family. It's essentially like Paranormal Activity as a reality TV show, except that sounds way more interesting than the book actually is, because it's descriptions of that TV show through the eyes of, I think it's one of the survivors doing a blog. So there's a bunch of like meta commentary in there, and it's all a bit much. And also the writing style, like trying to get in this voice of, I guess, who is a younger internet savvy girl, being written just as this really trite and unpleasant character. Like, things that she actually writes in her blog post in this book are things like, it might sound cliche, but, and then they'll say something really cliche, and it's like, well, if you knew, then why did you write it? There'll be a whole thing, and she'll be like, you decide, or say like a joke and be like, hey, see what I did there? It's all that kind of like smarmy internet speak, or what people who are maybe not familiar with modern internet speak think kind of hip, ironic internet speak is. It's very try-hard, post-Joss Whedon imitation stuff. It's really unpleasant. And then on top of that, it's doing this thing, which is a bit of a trend in horror books at the moment, where like the characters are these like horror movie obsessives who then interrupt the narrative to give lectures about horror movie history, which I realize giving lectures is a theme of some of these books I've been talking about on both these lists. But like literally Stephen Graham Jones's My Heart is a Chainsaw, which is another book I read at the start of the year and almost made this list, but there was a bit more substance and style there for that one. But that literally has a character writing high school or undergraduate essays for a horror movie studies class that interject in the chapters, except they're not like deep analyses. It's all just, hey, have you heard of this movie called A Nightmare on Elm Street or The Texas Chainsaw Massacre? Like, it's really surface level references that are then explained at length. So it's like, you know, I don't think people who aren't familiar with The Texas Chainsaw Massacre aren't necessarily reading this type of book, and then people who are already know about it and get it. But it is particularly egregious here in A Head Full of Ghosts, where like, rather than describing the action that is happening in the book, it will go on and describe a scene from another movie. Like, it'll retell scenes from The Exorcist or The Thing or The Evil Dead, and then say, it was like that part in The Thing when, and then it'll describe a whole scene. It's like, just tell us the scene that is happening rather than describing a better scene from a better movie. And then it gets really into like the South Park member berry style of references, where it'll just list all these, again, really like popular surface level horror franchises, and it'll be like, it'll describe something and then say, it was like The Exorcist, it was like Paranormal Activity, it was like No Exit, it was like Evil Dead, it was like The Yellow Wallpaper. We even get a, it was like House of Leaves, that's also in between her saying things like, and it was cray cray. So on top of the writing style, on top of the really superficial, unhelpful references, it also does kind of a, it was like House of Leaves, in that it does some metatextual stuff that doesn't work, where it's like, well, was this a hoax? Was it not? And it sort of spells out the mystery of the possession hoax at the end of the book in one of the blog posts. And at that point, I'm like, can we just leave this as implied, and you can pick up on it and think about it yourself, rather than like spelling out the subtleties or what subtleties there are of this book? Like, yeah, I haven't been particularly impressed with a lot of the like more recent horror stuff that I've picked up. Tremblay, Jones, Hendricks, this kind of group of contemporary horror writers. And this book, I think, is the worst of them that I've read, and really through all these different demonstrations sort of is emblematic of tendencies that I think make them pretty shallow and forgettable and really unenjoyable to actually read. So I kicked off my best books of the year list with a couple of books by Edgar Rice Burroughs that I thought, you know, were the best, or at least the most enjoyable and amusing of all the pulp science fiction novels and stories that I surveyed this year. And I've got Burroughs here again at representing the worst of that pulp science fiction survey. You know, I'm sure there's a lot worse stuff out there. And I think certainly, you know, compared to some of the other stuff I did read, you know, there probably was a lot worse. But those books I'm sort of treating as curiosities. You know, I was never really expecting to like them, and I'm a little bit more removed and treating them as, you know, sort of their time as relics. I'm not really expecting to get much out of them. The Burroughs stuff I was, and while certainly not as prevalent and influential as the Tarzan books or even the John Carter series, every secondary piece of pulp science fiction scholarship that I consulted or looked at during the survey all said that Burroughs' best book was The Land That Time Forgot, or the overall Caspak series, because this is a series of three novellas. They were all serialized, I think, in 1918, and then they were all collected together and published under the title of the first volume, which is The Land That Time Forgot. But to distinguish that from the collection itself, the books being, yeah, the first one's The Land That Time Forgot, the second one as The People That Time Forgot, and then the third book is Out of Time's Abyss. Together, they are called the Caspak series. Now, Caspak is the name of a, you know, underground lost world. A thing that was, you know, very trendy at the time with Jules Verne and Arthur Conan Doyle and stuff like that. And, you know, throughout Burroughs science fiction as well, I think this is like the third or fourth book where he has a, you know, underground dinosaur populated lost world. But the thing that sets this book apart that's meant to make it the best of Burroughs works is that the reason that this lost world, which yeah, is populated with like dinosaurs and it's like a prehistoric thing, lots of prehistoric animals and cultures and things like that, is that rather than being a relic of time gone past, it's this separate ecosystem where each animal or creature sort of progresses through the stages of evolution and themselves. Like they're born, I think, as like tadpoles, and then they evolve through, you know, what Burroughs calls separate higher orders of evolution, going up through fish and birds and mammals and yes, through human stages of evolution as well. So it's more historical than cultural in this case, where we get like sort of Neanderthal-like prehumans, hominids, rather than like the cannibalistic Africans of Tarzan. But still the idea of the civilized European white male is seen as the natural peak of evolution that these, you know, the surviving animals within this world will eventually attain. That is the height of their evolution. This is an intriguing and rather unusual premise, at least, but it's not what these books are actually about. Like, this doesn't get discussed and discovered until halfway through, like, the third volume, right? So it's kind of a reveal rather than a premise or an actual novum upon which the science fictional story can be created out of. It's just sort of like a very standard lost world romp, and then at the end they're like, oh, and by the way, we were all evolving. And then there's like, you know, half a novella of, yeah, this kind of intriguing, albeit extremely misguided, evolutionary premise. And then the first volume has nothing to do with this lost world at all. It's this really bland, like, World War One submarine thriller about a missing boat. Like, that's how they get to this world, but it's a whole book's worth of, yeah, submarine chase that's extremely dated and irrelevant and just dull as dog shit. And then the second book is just your basic standard lost world romp, except with, you know, an extra sprinkling of Burroughs all over it. So it's just, it's white men going around talking about how good they are, and they come across these amazing creatures that, oh my god, this is this extinct tiger that we didn't know still existed, or wow, it's an actual pterodactyl. And then they never like observe or investigate these creatures. They all just, every scene in this book is, oh my god, it's an amazing creature, and then a white guy shoots it in the face, and then they eat it and complain about how, you know, it's not real meat or real animals like they have back in England. It's insufferable. And yeah, the two books into a three book series at this point, and like, it's all set up, nothing has happened, and you get like sort of lip service to this kind of interesting idea in the third book. Like, I have no idea how this is considered his best book. For me, it was such a slog, it was such a disappointment, and it really just embodied everything that was dull and off-putting about, you know, this period of science fiction that I've so far, you know, steered pretty clear of. You know, it certainly wasn't as fun as Martian brain transplants and plant people and things. So on my best books list, I had Hong Kong's Babel, which won the Locus and the Nebula Award this year. And the year before that, well, both those awards were won by P. Jelly Clark's book, A Master of Djinn, which is my seventh least favorite book that I read this year. So this is magical alt history fantasy in Egypt with Egyptian gods, Egyptian magic, Egyptian monsters, that sort of thing. I will be talking about this book and Clark a bit more in the upcoming Pyramids episodes, I think. But yeah, it was looking forward to this one. Seemed kind of original and different compared to a lot of the other stuff that's getting pushed in mainstream fantasy at the moment. And yeah, again, was just really let down. Like, this is a kind of magical murder mystery detective story, again, in the weird parallel fantasy Egypt. So that all sounds cool. But man, the writing was really clunky and obscure, and it was really hard to follow the plot of what was going on. And that might also be because there isn't much of an investigation or a plot. Like, the main character just kind of stumbles around, doesn't really work anything out, and then like literally gets handed envelopes explaining the clues they've missed and, you know, directing them where to go next. Like, there's no real drive to the story. story. It's just following this protagonist who seems to be very bad at her job and also like just a really unpleasant and unlikable person, which all of that can be fun, but really wasn't in this case. And yeah, to the point where this is another one I didn't finish. I gave up halfway through. I'm like, I don't really get what's going on and I don't care. So really, really quite disappointed by that one, because it was one I was going into thinking it might be a bit more my style than a lot of other recent fantasy that I've dipped my toes into. Now at number 6, we have another sort of acclaimed current fantasy effort in the form of N.K. Jemisin's The World We Make from 2022. So last year, this is the sequel to her 2020 book, The City We Became, a book I really didn't enjoy or like at all. This is despite me being quite a huge fan of Jemisin's Broken Earth series, which she wrote before this series. I needed to give it a reread. I've calmed down a bit on the Broken Earth series. Like at the time, I was like, oh my God, this is the best series. And I've kind of settled down a bit by now. I don't think maybe it stacks up to something like the Book of the New Sun or whatever. But yes, very enjoyable, very original, very well crafted and fascinating world and characters in that story. Not so much in these city books, which is, it's like an anti-Lovecraft pastiche sort of thing, but it's really just about people who become the spirits of cities. Like the main characters are the spirits of the separate boroughs of New York, which just means they act in a bunch of like stereotypes and cliches. And I read the sequel and it's maybe worse in that it kind of becomes a really dull teen romance novel, like the cities start falling in love, except it doesn't really go anywhere. And then, yeah, this is meant to be, they're like the inhabitants of the cities, and then the bad guy is this woman who is an inhabitant of Rillia, the Lovecraft city where Cthulhu lives, and it's like this post-colonialist, anti-racist, like rewriting or even just interaction with Lovecraftian fiction, except instead it's just this like teen romance novel, and none of it really makes any sense. And instead of it being a big cosmic Lovecraftian thing, there's this whole silly mayoral race plot where it all becomes about political technicalities and campaign finances, as if like the laws about running for office matter against like modern politicians, let alone, you know, cosmic entities. I don't know why, like there's a big gotcha moment where they discover a technicality in the rules or something, and it's like, how does that defeat the spirit of Rillia? Like this is written in a post-Trump world as well, so it just seemed pretty naive and silly. And like the evil corporation in it is literally called Evil Corp, or I guess like that's the nickname they give it, but it's referred to throughout the book. Like the bad guy is Evil Corp. And yeah, much like my problems with Good Omens too, there does seem to be a lot of like emotional jackknifing, like suddenly characters are interested in each other or they're not, and they have these emotional breakthroughs just when the plot needs them to. They're not really built up. Yeah, not a fan of this series, and I have struggled with all of Jemisin's stuff outside of the Broken Earth trilogy that I've tried to read. Like her story in the Out There Screaming collection that I talked about in the other episode is quite good, though I don't think a standout, and I didn't really understand the point of it, so maybe it's not that good, I don't know. But her short story collection was okay, but I sort of came away from it with a lot of problems. And I've tried to dip into her earlier series a couple of times, and I've just bounced straight off them, so I don't know if I'm a fan of Jemisin so much as I am of The Broken Earth. But yeah, a doubly disappointing follow-up to that series that I still think is probably one of the best fantasy series of all time, and certainly one of the more lauded modern versions. Okay, number 5. Switching gears again, there are another big, well-renowned literary name, and one that I'm quite partial to. I'm talking about Kurt Vonnegut and his book Hocus Pocus from 1990. Yes, I'm a white guy with a literature degree, so I am a big Kurt Vonnegut fan. And you know, I was a bit worried that maybe his stuff doesn't really stand up to when I first read it when I was a bit younger. Though I think I mentioned on one of the podcasts with Ellis, but I did reread his book Breakfast of Champions, which is my favorite of his, in the last couple of years. Just to see, and I was fully expecting to come away from it going, oh, don't know, and instead I absolutely loved it, really thought it held up and was as brilliant and interesting and funny as when I first read it. So that kind of prompted me to then do a bit of Vonnegut cleanup, because there are a few Vonnegut novels I haven't read, and they're all the ones that nobody talks about that I didn't even know existed until like I really went digging. And yeah, this is one of them, and maybe like I get why people aren't talking about this book. So this is about a literature professor and Vietnam vet who gets fired from his job for sleeping with his students, which is a trope of, you know, white guy literature that I'm really quite sick of. But then he becomes a prison English teacher and teaches a black prison population to read, and then they overthrow him and form their own government, and then he runs the prison and they overthrew him with the liberal education that he provided them or something. I don't know. I don't really get it. This is another one I gave up on halfway through. Didn't really have any idea what's going on. I think that is because the book is extremely dated. Like, it really seems tied up in kind of specific references to Vietnam and the civil rights movement that don't really translate or aren't familiar to a modern audience, or at least to me. I didn't really get this one. I mean, the whole thing that it's based on, that is like the lead line, like I think it's the first line in the book, or it's early on, and then it's in all the blurbs and summaries I read of it, is that this is a book about a guy who has killed exactly as many of people as the number of women that he has had sex with. And I don't get that. I don't get what the joke is there. Like, is it a sex and death thing, which, like, I don't really like as a trope anyway, but it's just sort of presented as, get it? And then people always trying to guess the number throughout the book. Like, I don't understand this book. So either it went way over my head, or perhaps because, you know, Slaughterhouse-Five is a household name and this one isn't, perhaps suggests that, it's not among his best works. All right, going back a few years for number four, the fourth worst book I read for the first time in 2023, I have a far less known author and novel in the form of I, Vampire by Jodi Scott. And I think I left this out when I said I didn't read any other vampire books this year when I was talking about rereading Twilight. But I guess this is a vampire novel. Is it? I don't know. This is another one I didn't finish. This is the sequel to a book I read the previous year called Passing for Human from 1977, which is right in the boom of like 70s American New Wave science fiction that is very critically revered and which I do enjoy a lot. This is one of the lesser known works of that, which is about aliens coming to Earth and evaluating the morality of humans by posing as historical figures. Like, the main character is a version of Virginia Woolf. And it's a pretty messy book. It's not a great book, but yes, it was interesting to me because the ultimate decision becomes that humans shouldn't be allowed to live because of the way they treat other animals. So of course that got a footnote in my book. But yeah, this is the sequel to that. It's called I, Vampire, and suddenly there are vampires, I guess, which the main character is, or are they? I don't know. This is about a character who seems to be a vampire and falls in love with the Virginia Woolf alien from the first book. But I have absolutely no idea what's going on in this book because it's just nonsensical. It like jumps from place to place. There's no kind of like thread from one scene to the next about like what inspired the next thing. The writing itself, it's really hard to follow. Like, this is one I attempted to read physically because there's not an audible, an audiobook or even a print to text, a PDF version of this book that I could convert to audio. So I was attempting to read this physically, and after about 8 months of false starts of just reading sentences over and over again, trying to work out what the hell was going on, I threw in the towel. And then what summaries I have been able to find tell me that it seems like it all ends up being just a dream anyway. So probably did the right thing in bailing on this one. Pretty disappointed by that, because again, it seemed like something that might be up my alley. And Passing for Human wasn't a great book, but was interesting and deviated from that kind of American New Wave feminist tradition in a lot of interesting ways. But yeah, this book is just a mess in every single way. The characters, the premise, the writing, like none of it works. Coming in at number three, so we're on the inverted podium of the worst books I read in 2023. We have another 70s American New Wave feminist science fiction, this time kind of semi-cult classic in the form of Susie McKee Charnas's Mother Lions book from 1978. This is the second book in her Holdfast series of novels, following Walk to the End of the World from 1974, which I did read and thought was fine. I mean, it really does kind of feel like walking to the end of the world. It's quite a slog. But the premise of this series is we're in post-nuclear catastrophe. There are no other animals and there's no vegetation. It's all been nuked and all the surviving men have enslaved the women and treat them like cattle and use them as slaves and feed on seaweed. And then so the first book, Walk to the End of the World, is about the main character, the protagonist, who is one of these enslaved women escaping this dystopian society and running off into the wilderness to try and find a better life. And then this book, I can't remember whether it's the same character or not, kind of furthers that, and we get more of a description of the, you know, kind of Amazonian feminist utopian enclave enclave that she escapes to, which is extremely cliche, this idea of the naturalistic utopia in contrast to the technological utopia. What it also has that kind of breaks expectations here is a whole lot of horse fucking. So the thing about these utopian kind of pastoral Amazonian women is that they're like biologically engineered, like superwomen, but they train their whole lives because they live without men, but they've worked out that they can get pregnant by having sex with horses. And I don't know how that works, something to do with the genetic manipulation, but they not only do that as some kind of like weird 70s feminist metaphor for, you know, getting in touch with nature and returning to the wilderness and things, but like it goes into a whole lot of detail about how these women like train their whole lives to be able to endure the horse penetration, and that's why they're like, I guess, kind of semi-eugenically weeding out weaker women who die from having sex with horses, and that's why they're so strong and so in touch with nature. And fuck, man, I don't know. And this wasn't in a fun, kind of ridiculous, absurdist Garth Marenghi kind of way. This was all extremely po-faced and serious. And this is kind of the last of these 70s feminist sci-fi series that I've got around to reading. And as much as I really do enjoy all of those books, like, I love The Female Man. That is absolutely one of my favorite books of all time. But by the time I've sort of trickled down to this and I'm reading about the horse fucking as test of strength, I don't know, man, I got better things to do with my life. So, yeah, another one I didn't quite finish. I did go a little bit further than that, and, like, I don't know. Like, maybe it's meant to be ridiculous, because this is one of those critical utopia things, and that the main character rejects this as well. Like, they are meant to be an overblown caricature of that getting in touch with nature trope that she then rejects and sort of comes back to in the middle. I don't know. I didn't read the other two books from, but I do know that she does become, like, a hunter-gatherer, kind of wilderness rebel leader who reinstates a pastoral mode of existence rather than a technological one. So even if she's rejecting the horse fucking, it's still that kind of ideal, which, you know, kind of makes that the most interesting part of it. It was certainly different, but yeah, not for me. All right, let's start winding things up with number two, the second worst book I read this year. One I've already talked about on the main episodes at some length, which is R11, Son of Rosemary from 1997, the sequel to Rosemary's Baby. Yeah, I won't go into detail about this one here, like I did talk about it in the Antichrist episode of Good Omens, so go there if you want to hear my thoughts. But yeah, another big name, one of these big literary figures in R11. Probably not as well known, but probably, you know, on par with Kurt Vonnegut, and probably more popular and influential with works like Rosemary's Baby and Stepford Wives and Boys from Brazil and things. Like, kind of secretly a very influential author, especially in the genre and sci-fi horror space. But yeah, this book is just him kind of shitting all over his legacy by writing what seems to be a really cheap and nasty rushed cash-in sequel to Rosemary's Baby, but also 20 years after the fact. But also, maybe isn't that damaging, because I don't know if anyone really knows that it exists. I don't even know if it was like a big deal at the time, if it sold a lot or whatever, but either way, it doesn't seem like he's even trying with this one. It just seems like rushed out, completely minimal effort, and like the best parts of it are ripped off from the bad but surprisingly interesting and innovative TV movie sequel that came before it. So I don't know if it was meant to be a cash-in that just didn't work or did work and has been forgotten, but yeah, I probably had a like less unpleasant and exhausting time reading this book than some of the other books on this list. Like, this is one I finished because it is very short, but just got to the end and went, there was absolutely no substance or anything there. So this is so far down on this list because I just don't think there's like anything to recommend it. I mean, no one even has sex with a horse to prove how strong and powerful they are. So yeah, steer clear of that one. Not that I think anyone will have been intending to check it out after the quasi-review I gave it on the Good Omens episode. Okay, number one, the worst book I read in 2023. For the first time, but I think also out of any book, I don't make a habit of reading particularly terrible books again. Although, having said that, I did reread Twilight, which I do think is one of the worst books I've ever read. So this has got me thinking, is Twilight worse than the book that I haven't said the title of it? The worst book I read last year is a book called Enclave by Claire G. Coleman. And while I think Twilight is perhaps morally worse and its impact has left the world far lesser place than this book, which I imagine a lot of listeners probably don't even know about as an actual work of fiction, I think, like, yeah, this is a worse and less interesting book than Twilight, which is saying something. So Claire J. Coleman is an Australian author. She's an Indigenous woman. I believe she's of the Noongar people in what is now called Western Australia, out near Perth, which I think is where she's from originally. She has recently relocated to Melbourne, or Naam, the Indigenous land name that is starting to be used more frequently, which is cool. But yeah, I think she moved over here pretty recently, which is semi-significant because Melbourne, I think it's called Melbourne in the book. I'd have to double check, but I'm pretty sure it is. Yeah, it plays a central role in the story. It's where it's set. And Melbourne itself is the titular utopian enclave. So this is a dystopian story about a society where, like, I guess they're rich, kind of privileged people have walled themselves away inside, this fortified city. And this is ostensibly from an outside world that's gone to shit after, like, global warming and financial collapse and all kinds of stuff, right? It's sort of meant to be Mad Max style out there, and then they're the last, bastion of safety. And it's I'd say fairly generic dystopian story of the protagonist's disenchantment with their civilization and then their escape and their finding of a utopian, again, enclave, the name of the book, that is much more in tune with, like, nature and things. And then they join with a resistance force with the idea of taking down the dystopian society, which is, as we'll discover, all pretty standard fare. So why am I reading this book? Coleman is an author who's gaining a bit of a reputation as a leading Indigenous Australian science fiction author, which is an area I'm interested in doing some further work on. And she's won a bunch of awards and things, mostly within Australia. I don't think she has a particularly global reputation as of yet. But her first book was called Terra Nullius, which is the, name that the British colonizers gave to Australia when they invaded it. That translates to no one's land or nowhere land. The idea being that the Indigenous population weren't counted as people or traditional owners or everything, and the British painted the land as uninhabited and therefore for the taking. It's what's the American equivalent called? Manifest Destiny, that sort of idea. And this book is about Terra Nullius, and it is, it's about a land that has been colonized by invaders, and the protagonist is, one of these enslaved, colonized people. But the twist halfway through the book, and I am going to reveal it because you wouldn't read it without the twist, right? The twist is the selling point, and it's what got me to check it out in the first place, is that halfway through the book, you find out that this isn't a country, this isn't historical fiction talking about the British invasion of Australia. This is a science fiction book that's been set in the future and is about aliens who have recolonized Australia, or I think other countries as well, but the story is set in Australia. So this is supplanting the British invasion of Australia with and likening it to an alien invasion of, I guess, modern day Australia, which is an interesting premise, certainly from Coleman's viewpoint. It's not necessarily an original one in that, this is War of the Worlds. The opening paragraph, or one of the opening paragraphs of H.G. Wells's War of the Worlds, specifically appeals to the supposed genocide of the Tasmanian Indigenous cultures by British colonizers and says, this is like that, but what if aliens came to London? But yes, Wells was if not a colonialist, then a proud Brit. He's an old dead white guy, whereas Coleman is actually rewriting the story from the point of the colonized, from the Indigenous people. So it's quite interesting. It's a bit rough. It's certainly a debut work, but it's quite intriguing, quite impressive. So yeah, she's someone I kept an eye on. She had a second science fiction book, I think, from called Terrible Lie, which again sort of draws the science fiction parallels with the Indigenous experience. This time we're going for space opera, or it is more military science fiction sort of story about space fighters in an ongoing alien conflict, participating in space dog fights and things. And this is, drawing parallels to the treatment of Indigenous Australians who were sent off to fight in World War I and World War II, for a country that sent them off to die for a country that, didn't treat them particularly well, like proper people and all of that. So again, really intriguing, interesting premise. And there's some, interesting story stuff in that book there's like a group of Indigenous Australians that are on the ground back on Earth in Australia, who are, traveling to get home to their traditional country, which has been ruined by nuclear tests and things. So again, talking about the exploitation of Indigenous land for war and colonial prospects. That side of it is pretty interesting. Unfortunately, the science fiction side, the space dogfighting, is like some of the worst stuff I've ever read in terms of it. It's extremely bland and generic and just really trite, I guess is the word. Like, we are talking, who's the Ready Player One guy with the Gunters and everything? Ernst Klein, he had his book follow-up to Ready Player One was Armada, which is another military space thing. I mean, it's essentially Ender's Game. But, this is on par with Armada for, like, just writing quality, which if you're not familiar with how terrible Ernst Klein's writing is, I would recommend going and listening to the 372 pages that we won't get back podcast, which was named after, that is how many pages are in the book. They've then gone on to read a whole host of other books, which I cannot recommend the Tyra Banks Model Land series enough, but the second book they did after Ready Player One is they did Ernst Klein's follow-up book Armada. So if you're interested in getting a taste of that without actually putting yourself through it, I'd recommend checking out that podcast. But this book is on par. Like, to give you an example, and this is sort of the one that this has stayed with me as an example of, like, terrible and particularly trite science fiction writing, is when introducing the main character of that book, the main fighter pilot, there is a paragraph that, like, literally says, someone gives her an order or whatever, and she decides to disobey it because she wasn't like other people who obeyed, like, petty things like the rules. And it actually says, like, the rules. It's like, she's not a regular pilot. She's a cool pilot. Yeah, so she's a rebel. She's a maverick. And I think that passage ends with her requesting a flyby. So even if it was well written, not particularly original, which is fine. Books don't have to be, wholly original stories, but they do have to bring something. And while Terra Nullius certainly and The Terrible Lie even, had this interesting new perspective and spin and ideas on it, Enclave really has, like, nothing going for it. Like, it is dystopia by numbers. The writing's not great. It's not as bad as The Terrible Lie, but it's not as good as Terra Nullius, which I didn't really have a problem with the writing of that. Enclave, though, it's not the writing. It's just the story itself has, like, this story. You haven't read this story, but she's sad and bored and disenfranchised for what is, like, half the book, or a good third. It seems it's, like, this is a short book. I think it's, like, just under or around 200 pages, and, like, the first 70 pages are just like the protagonist's mum being drunk and sad, and then you think that's setting up, planting some characterization, but then that goes nowhere and the mum disappears from the story and is never brought back. So I don't know why we spent so much time with her being drunk and sad. I mean, I guess to show us that perhaps this supposedly good society is actually a bad society. But as with American Psycho, where I thought probably could have been done more efficiently, probably only needed like one scene of the mum getting drunk rather than 70 pages of it. But then, like, it drags for 70 pages, and then all of a sudden, things just start happening. Like, she falls in love, she escapes the city, she's living in, like, a survivalist commune, scavenging for food and things, and it's like, okay, things are gonna start getting going here, and this is what the story's gonna be about. But even that just, like, ends, because all of a sudden, she's taken to somewhere else, and she goes to Melbourne, which is this amazing place with halal snack packs are, and yes, there is an actual scene in the book where the character eats a halal snack pack, which is a popular food in Melbourne at the moment. It's become pretty trendy for, low-class takeaway food in the last 5 years or so, that you get from, like, kebab shops, fish and chip shops, takeaway shops. This is kebab meat shaved and put on deep-fried chips, like you would get from a fish and chip shop, with a bunch of, like, the garlic sauce and stuff. It's essentially a kebab on chips. I don't know. I haven't had one. I don't eat animals. But I bring that up because I said, she moved to Melbourne and this is her going, oh my god, Melbourne. But a bunch of reviews I've read online have specifically pointed out this weird scene with the snack pack. It didn't really jump out to me, other than I'd seen other people comment on it. But yeah, it's just like, she goes to Melbourne, is like, oh my god, Melbourne. And then she suddenly meets the person she was looking for, and it turns out they were part of the underground resistance and they're in love and they're going to go back and rescue everyone from the city. But they don't actually do that. It just ends with them saying they're going to. Like, it all happens at once. And it's like, she had this idea, I want to write this dystopian story. How do dystopian stories go? They go like this. And then all of a sudden she's like, oh, I've got to have something happen here. So it just happens. It's not, like, developed or anything. And then it's just like, I've got to end this now. So she met the person she loved and they were part of the resistance and she was a resistance leader. Everyone lived happily ever after, the end. Like, yeah, it drags and then it skips and then it's really rushed. I don't know. It just seems really undeveloped. Like, this seems almost like a first draft, and that is a really harsh thing to say. And I don't think Clay Conlon should give a shit what I think about her book, but like an editor or someone might say, okay, well, here's the skeletons of your story. How about we expand on these points, bring these bits in here? Like, the book is, it's very short, and I have a whole lot of sympathy, having gone through the publishing process myself recently, that, maybe she had this idea and she got stuck through this book and didn't know how to finish it and just had to get the product out there. Like, I understand that.
that, but that is what it feels like.
Yeah, I am a little bit shocked that this ended up getting published and marketed in the state that it's in. Because this book is just not, it doesn't feel done. It doesn't feel finished. Like, the story's complete, but there's not enough of it. And yeah, I don't think it's just me. As I said, you know, other popular reviews on blogs and things have specifically pointed out the Halal snack pack scene and stuff and just gone, this is kind of weird and rushed and awkwardly written. And then a lot of the more official reviews and stuff have, you know, reading between the lines, are codedly saying the same sorts of things, where they spend a lot of the review talking about how important Coleman is as a author and a voice for this kind of perspective, and then sort of make some gestures towards it not being as well constructed as her previous works and not having the thematic depth, that sort of thing, which is, you know, academic code for this book seems like a first draft that wasn't fully developed and kind of feels unfinished and rushed. And yeah, it doesn't have that like Indigenous perspective spin to it, which I don't want to pigeonhole her into that, but there is no twist on the dystopian formula. It is just a generic dystopian story about another thing, and they escape and they hook up with someone who's part of the resistance in the more naturalistic utopia. Like, there's no reveal about the cause of the dystopia. There's no reveal about the nature of the utopia. There's no interaction of the thing. It is just a by the numbers generic dystopian story. So I don't know what happened here. I have a lot of sympathy if this was just something that sort of got away from her that she's not completely satisfied with. But if I'm meant to take this seriously as a work of important, you know, cutting edge science fiction, or, you know, a major new work by an important new author, this really isn't up to scratch. Like, this, it doesn't even live up to, you know, all the pulp stuff that I've been reading, and, you know, doesn't bring anything new to the dystopian formula that was, again, established by H.G. Wells with When the Sleep Awakes over 100 years ago now. So yeah, I don't know. I thought this one could have gone either way after my experiences with her first two novels, but it ended up being, you know, pretty dire. I wanted to like this one, but alas, it was not to be. All right. Those are the worst books I read in 2023. Hopefully you found some kind of enjoyment and found a bunch of books to steer clear of or check out of morbid curiosity. I don't know. But yeah, I'll see how I go this year. We'll see if I can find something as equally abysmal for 2024. I think that's it for the bonus end of year stuff. I've been putting together the Pyramids episode, so I will be back with that when it's done, probably within the next month or so. We'll see how I go. But yeah, I won't see you then. Bye.
And we're clear.